Hello and welcome to the Untalented podcast. I think this might be the 51st episode.
Wow.
So we're pretty proud of that. But I'm here with David Johnston, who is the founder and CEO of Accept and Proceed. Welcome.
Thank you. It's
How's your day been so far?
been beautiful, actually. Yeah, I went to the gym before here and I feel fresh and exercised, which is like that feeling of fatigue I really enjoy just post-exercise. So I'm feeling nice and
The
relaxed.
endorphins are high,
Yes.
ready to have some good conversation. I'll do a really quick intro on Accept and Proceed because for anyone who doesn't know about Accept and Proceed, they are a design agency, design consultancy working with the likes of Nike, Beats by Dre, Dickies is another one of your IKEA. Who else have I missed out on here? But super famous for doing, beautiful, aesthetically driven work. Really focused around helping brands become better and making better choices. But I'll kick off with the question that we always start with, David, is who was the first person to make you feel talented?
It's a good question. Thank you. It's an interesting question in the fact that I've been talking to my kids recently about how people make us feel and situations make us feel. And we've been talking about the fact that no one can really make you feel anything. They're saying, oh, this so-and-so made me feel angry or sad. But actually, you choose to respond to a situation. So I just wanted to kind of the fact this is called Untalented, I did wonder whether on my journey through life, whether it was people that made me feel untalented that actually gave me that sort of determination to think about, my future and wanting to sort of almost rebel against that. But that said, I think I've had incredible people in my life, from family members and friends and colleagues and teachers. I do remember early in my life, my mum doing lots of cool stuff like growing crystals with sugar and, blowing eggs and, standard stuff, making spaceships out of boxes. And then as I went through life, I think I just actually loved exploring and creativity. I loved making tree houses and playing on my BMX, and yes, creating visual things became a real passion. And I really, really loved, the kind of energetic exchange that seemed to be present when you were in a creative state, either on your own or with others. And I do remember from a communication perspective, I do remember my papa, David Johnston the First, saying to me, actually at my nana's funeral, who was his wife, but he kind of had the wherewithal to compliment me on a speech that I gave at her funeral. And he said I was an incredible speaker. And I do remember that staying in my mind, that I actually quite liked that process. But I don't think it was about talent, and it was more about, creativity and exploration. And as I went through life, I've been in bands. I loved like creating music with others, and now creating brands and design with teams is a passion of mine. But that word talent, I don't know if I honestly consider myself to be talented. I've achieved things. I got into Central Saint Martins. I remember that being an achievement, but that started 3 years of quite hard work and exploration. So it's a funny thing, this word talent, because you can never rest on your laurels. When you think about it, you're simultaneously the most talented and the least talented you're ever going to be right now, because all the accumulation of everything you've learned means you're like top of your game right now. But everything that you're about to learn, you don't know yet. So I don't know. I think that I don't actually consider myself to be hugely talented, but I love the creative process and I love working with others to create things that are unexpected and wonderful.
Do you think there's an element of nature nurture from a creative stance? Do you think that some people are inherently born to be creative, or is it something that is always learned?
I think every human is creative. Absolutely. I think we're born creative. And in a way, the labels that we grow up with or put upon ourselves restrict our creativity or perceived creativity. This idea that you're in a creative role or, oh, I'm not creative, I don't buy that. I think that we're all creative, but we just forgot it at certain points. And it's kind of like society. It's a funny thing growing up, isn't it? All kids are creative. You see that every single one of them is creative and they respond to things in real time in a way that's very natural. And I wish more grown-ups did, but it seems like we all kind of put on this armor through our life and we get to, I'm not quite as old as your podcast. I'm not 51 yet, but like in my like late 40s, I'm starting to take all that armor off and starting to think that these labels aren't that helpful.
Yeah,
because we're all so incredibly unique. You know, I learned some facts the other day. 1% of the population has something called solar sneezing, which means when you look at the sun, you sneeze.
Yeah.
4% of the population actually sweats through this part of their nose when they eat onions.
Wow.
And there's this thing called ideathesis, which is basically people that visualize in diagrammatic form ideas the moment the ideas come to them. And people that do that assume that everybody does that, but actually we're all different and unique. Every single mind is different and unique and hugely creative because of it.
I
think that taking our armor off and actually getting to the multitudes that we are is probably the role that we actually have to try and achieve in life in some respects.
I remember like that kind of really innate sort of imaginary behavior as children is so I always laugh about this story with like friends, but I remember being a child and thinking that in the shower I could like shoot like water out of my fingers, but obviously there was this really like sad moment where I realized that the water was just running down my arms, and when I lifted my arm up it came out of my elbow, and I just remember the sort of sadness of being like, I'm genuinely Spider-Man, you know, and I have loads of nieces and nephews and get to spend time with lots of them, and there is something so brilliant about the way that they think about things in the world, and we do lose some of that, you know, as things get serious and you've got bills to pay and, you know, stresses in your life. I think it is a shame, but I do think there is something beautiful about the creative industry that you do get to still dip into that mode sometimes. Is that something that do you kind of try and inspire a bit of that childlike creativity at Accept and Proceed?
Yeah, absolutely. We build it into our business model. I think right from the earliest days when we actually had a studio not far from here, believe it or not, we ran an art gallery for 5 years.
Okay.
So on Kingsland Road, we ran in basically the front area of our studio, something called the 43M3 Gallery, because it was 43 meters cubed. So very nerdy graphic design naming. But we did some incredible things in there. It really was all about exploration and play.
Yeah.
And as that's evolved, we've moved studio to an amazing space over two floors on Downs Park, or the corner of Downs Park that you came to recently. And in there, we don't have an art gallery, but we have a room called The Continuum. And The Continuum is basically, you could call it our playroom in some respects, but it's like our research and development lab as well, might be the more kind of grown-up term for it. But it is a space that we create both psychologically and physically in the business to be able to explore. And more recently, we actually did something called New Patterns, which was us going out into the park and exploring with a movement expert called Will Brown through movement, various different things. And I think that, we're a company that recognizes that the fundamental things of being a human should be explored through business, I think. And humans breathe, they eat, they move, they love. And all of these things, I think, should be explored certainly through the creative process. And wherever you can build them into your business process, I think they should be as well. Because it gets to the more authentic truth of what a business actually is.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think that life is so serious. You know, you read the news and it's serious. And I think actually if you can breathe a bit of fun and a bit of freedom into your day-to-day, I think that's only going to, you know, benefit you. I'm going to read you something here that you wrote, actually, that was from your... It was your, hang on, what is it from? It's your impact report.
Okay.
And it says, years ago, I had the realization that companies using profit and growth as the only measure of success is just not where it's at. Certainly not for one as special as ours. Our existence should be guided by a static set of targets, should not be guided by a static set of targets and metrics, I thought. Our agency pulses with the energy, ideas, purpose, influence, awareness, and originality. At Accept and Proceed, we are committed to bringing about positive change for our work, connecting brands to culture, and helping envision a better future through the process. What a beautiful description of what your business does. Can you expand on that? Like, does that feel, I mean, obviously those are your words, but is that the reality of what happens behind closed doors?
Not every single minute of every single day. But I think, you know, my being a trained designer, you know, I kind of grew up into the world and was looking for things that would be meaningful to me, I suppose. And you know, a career that represented a life well spent was in the creative industry.
Mm.
But I studied quite a niche part of it as a graphic designer specifically. You know, yeah. I went to college in Hereford College of Art and Design and then on to Central St. Martin's and came out. And I was working in really the kind of aesthetic crafting for many, many years, like honing the skill of creating things that looked and felt incredibly enticing. And then when it came to actually setting up a business, I remember there was this sort of, I don't know, there was an appetite for it, but almost this sort of uneasiness around things like invoicing or, I don't know, new business and building a profile and marketing yourself and starting to create a team. Mm. Like I found those to be kind of business things. And I use this word business kind of incorrectly because we're not a business, we're a company at Accept and Proceed. And I see those two terminologies quite differently. But even as a company, there's these administrative tasks such as setting a business strategy or, you know, monitoring the finances of the business. But there's all these other things around culture and the relationships internally and externally of the business. And actually, when you start to not see them as administrative tasks, if you see them as creative acts, then you start to get closer to this kind of almost the way that great art is created. You know, this creative endeavor, we don't have to have a business plan that is like traditional business plans. We can think of the expanded spectrum of who and what we are and what we're here to do in the world.
Mm.
And the moment I was able to see a business plan as something different and a mission of our business as something different, then that was a huge unlock. Every single part of our business became a creative endeavor.
Mm.
And certainly that's made running Accept and Proceed, which I do, you know, with many other people, but it's made it very exciting to me because it feels like something emergent and it feels like something very creative and very honest and possibly akin to a great piece of art.
Mm.
You know, a great piece of art and great artists enter the field of art in a way that, I don't know, is similar to the way that great entrepreneurs come into the field of business.
Mm.
They look to change things and bring a truth of themselves into the world. And I think that's what we're doing at A&P.
Yeah. I think I often hear people talking about design as a problem-solving exercise, essentially, which in the entirety it is. But there is always an argument between whether is art or science, isn't it? You can't be both, is the theory, I guess. Is Accept and Proceed closer to art or is Accept and Proceed closer to science in the way that you work?
It's definitely existing in the overlap between those two things. And I think, you know, my career spanned big brand world. I worked at Interbrand, Newland Sorrell on massive, like, automotive and aeronautical and the Winter Olympics and huge big projects where it is a science of brand that you learn there. And it's scientific because of the money involved. You know, there's a lot at stake in a way, but let's be honest, a lot of that type of work gets the soul crushed out of it. And when I see really great work from ourselves or others, it feels like it comes from something that feels more intuitive, more instinctive, more akin to the way that great art is created in some respects. And I think I always struggled with why can't an agency exist between those two worlds? And I think we've quite successfully existed between those two worlds for a very long time.
Yeah. So obviously you're running Accept and Proceed right now with a talented group of people. As the CEO of the business, what does your average day look like? What do you spend your time doing?
It's an interesting question that, because I do quite a lot, and actually the role of the CEO is many different things. I mean, I would say that any day where I get to walk in Downs Park with someone or a group of people at least once is a good day. So a lot of like walk and talks, I like to get out of the office and kind of chat to people. But I think that the role of the CEO is sometimes directing. It's sometimes actually in service. It's sometimes just observing or holding space. So it's a very, very, it's a kind of multitude role, which sees me doing a lot of different things. I might be thinking about business strategy, thinking about partnership, thinking about creative leadership. And no 2 days are the same, really, in that respect. But when I'm in London, I'm always in the studio in Downs Park.
Yeah.
And yeah, I try and mix it up with as many sort of just discussions and just kind of feeling into what's actually happening in the studio as much as I possibly can. And then making decisions and guiding based on that where I can.
Do you, if you could sort of revert or rewind to when you started the studio, would you have foreseen this being your everyday? Would this have been a dream to be having the agency where it is right now?
I feel like Accept and Proceed is something very different now to where it started. And context is everything. I think the reason AMP started in a way was to explore the overlap that I'd experienced in my career, you know, of the sort of art and science of brand worlds. But I also looked around into the world and wondered why more agencies didn't seem to stand for something. And that, even to this day, really surprises me. You know, I think that through probably the first 10 years of running Accept and Proceed, it was all about the joy of creation. You know, we were creating incredible work, I think, which led to more incredible work. Mm. But we weren't as fully thinking about who we were doing it with, what we were doing it for, the cause and effect of what we put into the world in the way that we do now. And I think that all creators, business owners, brand owners, like everybody needs to start thinking very carefully about the cause and effect of everything that they're doing. Mm. So I couldn't have imagined the context of the world shifting so much since I started Accept and Proceed. Mm. But I think the best companies are built for and actively embrace change and they move with it. And I hope to be progressive in the field of brand and the field of creativity. I hope to inspire ourselves and inspire others. And so it's a real dream, honestly, to have the role that I have. It is a creative role. Mm. I get to, you know, every 12 months we co-create our plan for the next year as a team. Usually means that we turn off all the computers and get out of the studio for 3 days, 2 or 3 days. And those are incredible moments where you can really feel that, you know, something special is actually happening. Mm. But in terms of actually doing what I did when I started the agency, in terms of being hands-on in design, I kind of get that through other areas now. So for example, we've been running a sunrise gathering on Hackney Marshes for over a year now. And I'm really interested in that for a number of reasons. One, it's called We Don't Know What This Is. And we don't know what it is. Things are emerging. Like at the next one, which I'm guessing when this is broadcast will have already happened. So if anybody was there, hope you enjoyed it. That's weird, isn't it? Speaking from the future. But we've got Deborah Curtis and Gavin Turk, who are going to, with whoever is assembled, whatever micro community turns up, are going to facilitate the creation of some found nature art on the marshes. And we've also got a beautiful bowl ceremony and various other things going on that morning. And I also get to create a campaign around it. So it's a brand and it's a campaign and it's not driven by anything commercial. So I guess I'm lucky in the fact that I get to have creative practice, get to have a kind of exploration through the business. And I find it all very rewarding.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I guess that from the outside, and we've had this conversation already, but from the outside, there seem to be what Accept and Proceed is today, you know, the way it appears to me and to lots of people in the industry is completely different to how it appeared 6, 7, 8 years ago. And I think that there seems to be a lot more care in the way that you communicate with not just your clients and the industry, but with people who are kind of on the periphery of what you guys are doing. Was there like a moment where you decided, right, we need to change the way that we, you know, communicate with the industry? Or was it a natural evolution between people sort of saying, we need to do something about this? What happened?
I mean, it wasn't a sudden shift. I'd say it's been, but it's amazing that you've noticed it. And, you know, when anybody is like paying attention to what a company does, it's very rewarding that I do often hear from the people we speak to outside of Accept and Proceed, these types of bits of feedback. And that in itself gives us momentum to keep going with what we're doing. But it was quite gradual. I think that about 5 years ago, there was definitely this beginning of a turning in terms of us caring so deeply about the work that we produced, but starting to really care about what the work we produced was also doing in the world, and also caring very deeply about the world. So we started to care about our world internally, the world that was explored through our partnerships and the work that we did, but literally the world, and starting to, I think the whole world is starting to go through this shift where it is unavoidable, you know, to not see the effects that we're having on the planet. You know, this story of separation that we've been sold for so long, and actually brand has been a big part of. I think that that's starting to turn. We recognize that we're entangled, that we're not separate, because look at the cause and effect of our actions on our planet. And therefore you start to think about the cause and effect of all your work. And it's been gradual, but I think that the more you start to have the conversations with partners or have the conversations internally and start initiatives like our Spring Forwards, which, you know, sees us come together and really authentically create our business together as a team. When you start and it feels right, it gives you impetus to keep going.
Yeah.
And I think that in a way we're a little too early, and I'm sad to say that, but sometimes, you know, in pitch scenarios, we like, we're doing well and we're getting increasingly higher profile work, and it's incredible to see the journey. But the things that we're missing out on is in part because brands or businesses will say, you're right, but we're not ready. And so the product market fit of what we're saying in terms of the way that we think about brand and its potential in the world, we're a little too early, but I think it's coming. It's coming very quickly. And I think we'll be well positioned to be able to support businesses who truly want to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think that from what a lot of people will know Accept and Proceed for is beautiful aesthetic work, you know, beautifully designed, you know, impactful work, but the impactful side seemed to come as a, you know, a sort of secondary to like really beautiful, you know, aesthetically driven work. But I know that the reality of that now is very different.
Yeah.
You know, what you're doing with clients. Do businesses still come to you because they want that aesthetic, or are they starting to come to you because they want you to impact them from a, I don't know, a cultural perspective, or they want you to impact them from a, you know, them becoming more, you know, better as a business? Is that started to happen?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in a way we don't really take on work unless we think there's going to be positive impact in some way, shape or form through the work. And I think increasingly our initial early conversations are proving that, you know, with organizations. Just to explain the way that we create our work and our impact strategy. So basically, our promise to the world is designed for the future. And in isolation, that could sound quite lame. Designed for the future, what does it mean? But within that is really this idea of cause and effect of what we do. So who are we doing this work with? What's the potential of its work for the future? But actually, if you're going to have a promise to the world like design for the future, you have to be able to describe the type of future you hope for.
Yeah.
And we hope for a future which we describe as a more together world. So this is something that has been worked on really for a couple of years by our strategy team internally. But this, a together world, is a description. It's almost like a fractal description. When you think about a more together world, it's got many, many different kind of meanings as you start to unpack it. So if our intention is to create a world that is more together, then we have what we call kind of themes of togetherness. So they're things like reciprocity and resilience and interbeing. And the states of togetherness are ways that we can, one, think about the way that we create our work, but two, measure the impact of our work over time. So into being is basically based on the shift that we hope for from the story of separation to seeing ourselves as entangled with nature and the world. So if we get a new brief, we can look at, is there an opportunity to explore the impact of interbeing through this brief? And not only are we able to measure that at the end point of the project, if there is one, then we're also able to measure it, you know, in 12 months time and see, did we achieve this? Equally with things like resilience or reciprocity, you know, the project we collaborated on with the Royal College of Art, Second C, was all about reciprocity, starting to look at the damage that's been caused and will be caused into the future around sea level rise and really who should fit the bill, because it's just so incredibly unfair. The countries that are least perpetuating in the situation are being affected most. So Second C is a really interesting initiative that scores very highly on our impact around reciprocity. Equally, our work with Fondation Chanel really thinks about a number of things. Healing, for example, is another one of our states of togetherness that we measure. So healing, you know, resilience, these are all things in the type of work that we can achieve through a collaboration with Fondation Chanel. So really the fact that we've got an impact strategy allows design for the future and the vision of a more together world to be proven through our work. And that makes it not just words, it's actions that can be measured over time.
Because I think that we all, you know, we're in a period of time now where brands need to become more aware of the impact they're having on not just, you know, their customers or their, you know, their consumer base, but outside of that, you know, I think that is there anything that brands need to focus, you know, more clearly on to be able to be like a better version of themselves? Is there like is there a quick fix to being a better brand?
Like genuinely giving a fuck, if I'm allowed to swear. I think what we've seen for a long time is brands that are kind of out of step with their communities. You know, they're either one step ahead of or one step behind, but it's very rare you have this kind of synchronicity between brands and their audiences. And I think the reason for that is basically a skewed focus on commercial drivers for what you do. And I love the shift that we're really starting to see and sense from consumer thinking to citizen thinking. I read a book by John Alexander a couple of years ago now, but it was a big shift for me. It's called Citizens. And it was really you know, the author was part of the advertising industry for a number of years and fairly successful in it. But he asked himself the question, what are we doing to ourselves when we call ourselves consumer 3,000 times a day, which is the average amount of times that that message is projected to you in a metropolis like London. And consumer isn't a particularly good word. When you look it up in the dictionary, it means to devour, to wear away. You know, it's not a particularly suitable word, I don't think, for what we are, which is wonders of the universe. And citizen thinking is more around becoming in step and in sync with the organizations that align with your values and act accordingly. So that means that brands have got a massive opportunity to unlock the full potential of every single member of their community. So I'd start there, like starting to think about how you can communicate with, but be in conversation with the community that you're truly there to serve. And I'd say that's one of the biggest shifts that I think any business and brand can start to think about. And it's highly commercial. You know, there's a bigger opportunity if you have a richer conversation with your audience.
From like an agency perspective, people are scared or worried about trying to coach their clients to make decisions which don't allow them to make purely more money. You know, I think that, you know, we're in a very capitalist society. People are trying to get their brands in front of, you know, as many people as they can to make as much money as they can. Can you do that whilst being more purposeful, whilst being a better brand for the world?
Yeah, not only can you, you need to. I think any CEO of any brand that isn't looking at the next 5 to 10 years and seeing the need to evolve probably won't exist in the next 5 to 10 years. There is an existential threat to your business if you're not thinking this way. And, you know, so the statistic which I'm find really interesting is the fact that 78% of businesses currently listed on the NASDAQ, if they were to properly account for sustainability or environmental factors into their product or service or offering, they'd be unviable. So that means that 78% of everything around us needs to change. You know, we're reaching a point where the evolution of the way that businesses that were founded maybe 5+ years ago produce and drive through consumption or consumerism, they're just not fit for purpose for the future. And part of that will be legislated. You know, you start to think about the way that we recognize our world is changing, the way we need to shop differently and live differently. It's going to come very quickly. So businesses that are purely based on profit rather than purpose, I think, will fall by the wayside. They'll be part of that 78%.
Yeah.
And the new businesses that are coming through, I think, you know, the other stat that I find really interesting is the idea of the 3.5% rule, okay, which is a really interesting, it's also, you know, called the Bellman curve. There's various different examples of this, but it's basically how revolution happens.
Okay.
So if you can galvanize, for example, 3.5% of a society, then that's literally when revolution has happened historically. And in fact, Extinction Rebellion, we're working on that premise. They've never got anywhere near to galvanizing 3.5% of the population. But if they did, that's the point at which you might start to introduce citizen assemblies instead of the political shambles that we've got at the moment and things like this. So we don't want to work with everyone. We want to work with the 3.5% of companies that are either ready or close to ready or feeling like they would like to get ready to be part of the 3.5%.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's so fascinating, isn't it? Because, you know, if I look at, it seems like there's sort of two camps. And weirdly, if I use, like, you know, a couple of my nieces and nephews are older, you know, getting towards, you know, middle secondary school, and they seem to have a really good awareness of, like, what's happening in the world in terms of the environment and kind of, you know, being kind to each other and, you know, the people having whatever pronouns they choose to have is super cool in schools and stuff, which is great. And then there seems to be this sort of middle ground between people who are working really hard and in there. And then the older generations also seem to be really caring about the environment at points. You know, it seems like they have more. So there seems to be this sort of middle ground of people, if we're using the environment as an example, that lose touch with what impact they're having on the world. Is that a fair analysis from my side, or am I miles off there?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think the kids are wise, and they're coming in hot, as a friend said to me, recently. I think that it's incredible the awareness and the acceptance of people that have been born, you know, in past the year 2000. I think there's a different sort of realization, and I really hope there's some positive effects because of that. I do think there's always, like, we're talking about a globe, and in a way you're not off in some locations, but you're off in other locations wildly. I mean, we look at the way that huge amounts of our globe operates on, say, less than $1 a day or without mobile phones. And, you know, that is as present, you know, on this planet right now as Western society, that's hugely depleting the resource of our planet. Mm. And I don't genuinely think that we survive unless everybody survives. So there has to be this true kind of evolution where things become fair for all and all ages, all genders, or identifying as, you know, wonders of the universe, like whatever we become in the future. I think that that's the shift that I hope we are at the beginnings of. But in a way, we're sort of living through the dark ages of the future in some respects. These are the beginning, the gestation points, or the sort of the moments that are the seeds of a much more hopeful and more embracing future, I think, for all.
If we put that into more of like a commercial everyday perspective for you and for Accept and Proceed, what then does a perfect client look like? What if it came to you tomorrow? What would that feel like and look like to you?
I think any client that's truly able and willing to explore you know, who and what they are in the context of the world around us.
Okay.
Feels like a perfect client. I think that there's obviously disruptors and innovators that I find fascinating and mm-hmm. we love working with. There's also, though, people in the here and now, organizations that may be doing a lot of harm to the planet, but have a genuine aspiration to evolve. And we would love to work with them as well. And we think a lot, you know, the way that we can approach the work and the partnerships that we have through the Three Horizons framework. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's a very interesting framework that kind of started with McKinsey. It has a long lineage, but more recently it's been reappropriated by the likes of Kate Raworth, who's incredible, pretty much, you know, invented donut economics, which is a way of thinking about an economy that doesn't overshoot the Earth's natural boundaries. Mm-hmm. And if we had that approach to the economy rather than capitalist growth, we'd be fine. And I think that these kinds of new models are really, really interesting to explore. So the Three Horizons framework is basically a way of saying there is a dominant system always. And the dominant system that exists right now, in fact, always the dominant system, there's usually something within it that is flawed and destined to change. Mm-hmm. So you have Horizon One, which is organizations that exist within the current system. And we probably do about 70% of our work with Horizon One, but we want to work with those who are at the forefront or doing good or progressing Horizon One. But then you have Horizon Three, and Horizon Three is basically those operating in a way that is reflective of a world that we wish to live in the future. So Fondation Chanel is an example of Horizon 3 for us that we're working with. But equally, there's lots of pockets of Horizon 3 activity going on. And for us, it really is all moving towards a more together world.
Yeah.
Horizon 2 is probably the most interesting because they're the disruptors. The disruptors that are able to take you from Horizon 1 to Horizon 3. So they're things like Uber when it first started. It can be things like a natural disaster, or it could be a movement like Extinction Rebellion or Occupy, those kinds of things. And the disruptors basically are starting to provoke and starting to ebb away almost and help in some respects Horizon 1 start to die and become Horizon 3. Often, though, Horizon 2 can fall back into Horizon 1. So as we found with Uber, for example, it's not distributing all of its wealth. It's not actually benefiting in a massive way every single, you know, part of it. So if it was to become Horizon 3, we can obviously probably start to think about what Uber would look like if it was genuinely good for all through its activity.
Mm.
So it kind of fell back into Horizon 1 in some respects. But we like thinking about if we're working 70% in Horizon 1 right now, how much of our work can be made up with Horizon 2 and Horizon 3, and how can we evolve those percentages over time? So in 3 years, we might be working 50% in Horizon 1, 50% in Horizon 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And this is a really helpful framework that I like to, you know, think about in respect to the work that we're doing.
So just so I understand correctly, it's essentially classifying the work that you're doing and taking on to make sure that you're continuing to push that Horizon 3 work, even if you've got. Yeah, I mean, I've answered the question there.
We actually want to support. There's no necessarily good and bad.
Mm.
We want to support organizations that are working in all three of the horizons.
Yeah.
But for me, it's quite reassuring to know that dominant systems do change.
Yeah.
When you think about in music, for example, the dominant system in music in the 1960s was rock and roll. And this kind of fringe activity of pop, you know, music was really Horizon 3 at that time. And R&B as well. You kind of had these fringe moments. And then over time, pop and R&B has become pretty much the dominant system within the world that we live in today. So it's interesting to know that that's the cycles that we go through and be able to positively play a role in that.
Yeah, because I guess, as you mentioned before, change doesn't happen overnight. And I think that trends and, you know, what's happening in the world will influence, you know, hopefully, I guess what I'm hearing from, you know, your summary there is that the ultimate goal is to work with businesses that want to do better. And that seems like the underlying, you know, classification. But actually, it might be taking them on as a client to allow them, you know, that growth to do better. So, yeah, I find that I find that really interesting. In terms of, we spoke a little bit about it before, in terms about the sort of evolution of, you know, Accept and Proceed and doing things differently. Can you remember the first client that you, or a client in the kind of early change that you were like, we're actually making really interesting change for this business?
The first client.
Or an early client in that process?
I mean, we've had so many. I guess I'm drawn to the kind of higher profile things. I remember when we first started working on Nike's House of Innovation. It was interesting because it was their pinnacle, like flagship retail experience, but it was driven by something other than traditional metrics of success. So it was really about outreach and effectiveness of telling the truth of what Nike is, which is innovation. And when you think about the innovation that they have, what you're really talking about is pushing human potential forward. And so House of Innovation was an opportunity for us to think differently about retail spaces that weren't there just to sell product to people. It was these massive sort of empires of consumption. And I think that what we were able to do with, you know, as a small part in many, many more teams, but it was very effective in telling a new story of innovation for Nike and doing away in some respects with the sort of showbiz and veneer that had come before. So just because, you know, you've got a football boot that Cristiano Ronaldo's wearing, you don't need to make it into a serpent and give some big showbiz experience of it. Actually, the story of its creation, the 36 prototypes it got to take to, you know, to get to that point where you've got this innovation in a football boot, that's the story. So talking about the endeavor, I suppose, of innovation was something that was very powerful in House of Innovation. But as the world's changed, we're thinking about retail very differently these days. House of Innovation still exists in Shanghai and New York and Paris, but equally we're thinking a lot more about retail spaces that are truly engaging with community. You know, retail spaces that aren't as much retail spaces as community spaces for the future. And some of the work that we're, you know, you asked me about an early sort of endeavor. And I think House of Innovation for us has led on to a completely different way of thinking about bricks and mortar, thinking about the way that those spaces can truly serve the communities there that they exist for.
Yeah. I find the kind of retail, the spaces, and such a fascinating kind of part of the industry, because it seemed to be forgotten, or certainly from my perspective, people seem to forget how important those physical spaces are when getting to know a brand. And then obviously the whole, you know, COVID thing happened, and it just seemed like everyone ran headfirst into making sure that their consumer base is going back into the spaces. Like, for example, I went to the On Running store on Regent Street? I think it was on Regent Street. And I was genuinely blown away when I walked in about the like experience and how they looked after people, and they took you to different areas. And like, that was a really memorable experience for me, just buying a pair of running shoes.
Yeah.
And I think that that's such a beautiful part of the way that we experience brands.
Yeah, it is. I think I like that space as well. They seem to be doing sort of like technical emotion very, very well. In some respects, it sort of feels engineered and technical, but at other points it feels very emotionally connected. And they seem to be kind of that tension between the two things, they seem to be exploring well. But I think, you know, when I think about the success of, I was lucky enough to go to Shanghai for the launch of House of Innovation, and I walked into the lobby area and there was a group of students, art students, that were drawing the space. You know, so I've never seen that in a retail space before. I've seen it in art galleries in London many, many times, but I've never seen it in a retail space before. And, you know, that spot became the eighth most popular tourist destination in week three of it being open. And it just happened to smash all of its commercial targets as well, in terms of footfall and, you know, the revenue and all of those things. But it was doing it through almost a counterintuitive way. And I'm really interested in brands that can operate in this counterintuitive but highly commercial way at the same time. I think that the kind of more recently, an example, you know, to build on your On example, in LA, in Santa Monica, there is an incredible Rivian community space. Rivian is kind of, it's been described as the Patagonia of electric vehicles. They're very nice looking machines and all EV SUVs. But actually the space that they've got in LA is genuinely a community hub. So they've got a library, they've got a maker space, they've got like a creche. You can go there for a barbecue, and almost buying a vehicle is like maybe the fifth or sixth most important thing that you can do there.
Yeah.
But actually that it's really working for them as well.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, anybody that's exploring a different type of more authentic experience and conversation again with its community, I think they're the ones that are going to win.
Yeah. I think that is the thing that people notice. I think as humans, we've become so hypersensitive to when we feel like we're getting sold to. I know that, like, if I get a cold call, I'm just like, it infuriates me, which is an unnecessary and irrational emotion. But I think that if it feels like you're being sold to in a space, it doesn't feel authentic, and the authenticity behind some of the, like the House of Innovation, it never really feels like you're getting sold to, because there's so much in there that is interesting and engaging. Yeah. Do you think that, like, is that the trick to making sure, like, how do you make sure it's authentic for a brand?
Well, first of all, it comes back to that intention. Like, it's a real world. We're real people. Let's get real. And I think that you're right to get triggered by sales calls and hard sell, because in it is this lie about who and what we are. You know, I actually did, I'm not proud of this, but I did telesales in my younger years, you know, in actually when I was at university in the summer months, just because I had to have a token job. I was selling computer consumables in a place in Regent Street, and I had to have a persona. I was taught to have a persona that wasn't my own. So I was called Alex Rich.
Genuinely. You know,
genuinely is my, it was nominative determinism, right? I'm rich, and I had to have this persona on the phone of a sales, like a regional sales executive that would call people up and say, you know, I'm just happen to be in the area and I really care about all our accounts. And I see you're running the Canon printer there. And actually we've got a new product, which is super long life toner cartridges for your Canon printer. I would go through a spiel, which was just a script, and you're pretty much taught for any response. You know, and when someone calls you up, I've done that. I've been that person, and it's a horrible job. It's a soul destroying job. But what they're doing is lying to themselves. Ultimately, you know, I'm sorry for telesales people out there to say this, but I felt an inauthenticity around operating in that way that actually does trigger me now. If I experience hard sell in any way, I pretty much call it immediately. And it's because I think that we're lying to each other. We're lying to each other about who we are. And the truth of this species on this planet is wonderful. To an alien looking down on this planet, it's incredible. You know, we are incredible. Our imaginations, our innovation, our ability to be able to achieve things, and for it to be reduced down to this point where we're just inauthentically selling things to each other, it's like end of days stuff. So you're right to get triggered. Sorry to go off on one there.
No.
But I think it starts with just being real, I think, starting to understand why you exist, you know, what the truth of your organization is, you know, and realizing that, I don't know, the world we live in, I know one of the questions that you'd mentioned was, you know, an interesting fact about Accept and Proceed. And I thought about that question. An interesting fact about a lot of organizations, brands and businesses is that they don't actually exist. You know, we kind of assemble around a story of things, but a company isn't a company, it's a collection of people. And when you start to realize that we are all people, hopefully working for companies that we believe in, under a name perhaps, and hopefully a purpose, but that we're still real people. And that those stories that we tell ourselves are very powerful, because we become what we tell ourselves we are. But if we do become what we tell ourselves we are, then let us tell stories of hope. Let us tell stories of resilience and healing and interbeing, you know, and togetherness, ultimately. I think those are the stories that excite me and that the world needs now more than ever.
Well, I mean, that's what a way to finish. That was a thank you so much. It was great. And I'm sure we could talk for hours, to be honest, but that's a wrap.
Nice. Thank you, Woody.